thump that struck the living wall. After a few seconds, he uncovered his face. A wide-leafed creeper whipped before his eyes like a lion's tail. Something thorny scratched his chin. Pale fluids dribbled down the vegetative barrier, but new growth was already healing the punctures and thickening the wall further still. He slapped at the wide leaf, staring open-mouthed around him. He had some knowledge of the nature of the ether, and he knew that it was divided, as the particular talents of the 8 colleges of magic were similarly divided, and Felix had never seen Max work magic like this. Max rose silently, cracking the knuckles of the hand he had just used in his spell, and sending what looked like bark chips sprinkling from his fingers. The grey flesh still carried a faint jade glow.
"You see now why I was loath to aid you before. Everything about this is wrong. I am a mage of the light. Teclis himself taught the first magisters of the colleges that man cannot master all the winds of magic. To attempt to do so is to expose one's soul to the evils of chaos."
Felix didn't know what to say. And right then they had greater concerns. Gotrek's battle cry filtered thickly through the pulsing vines. Metal sang. And what of Gustav and the camp? Were they under attack as well? No, as harsh as it might have sounded, he would take this newly empowered Max Schreiber over the old one any day. "Can you get us out?" he said instead, cutting to the only thing that mattered.
"Of course," said Max,
as though it was so obvious he hadn't thought to raise the matter himself. The wizard clasped his hands tightly around his staff, his robes sinking into the surrounding shadow. Felix noticed his own fingers appearing to unravel and become one with the darkness. He could no longer feel the floor beneath him, and it melted into nothing even as he watched. The putrid nectar stink of magically invigorated plant life disappeared. If he could have filled his lungs with shadow, then he would have screamed.
"Gird yourself," said Max. "Grey magic takes some adapting to."
The first thing Felix became aware of again was sound. He could hear Gotrek's shouts interspersed with others, cries of anger and of pain, the clangor of weapons and the crunch of mail and meat and bone. Then images came, seldom in alignment with what he was seeing, and all the more jarring for it. To the metallic chatter of chain guns, he saw Kolya, thigh deep in rushing white water, engaged in fierce hand-to-hand combat with a pair of stout axemen in long mail shirts, round shields, and winged helms, before the darkness swept through them and they were gone. He saw Herschel Mann marshalling a firing line of Hochland long rifles, but the voice he heard yelling was someone else's. Fire fizzed back and forth between the opposing banks of the river, a trickle versus a raging torrent. Disembodied, Felix was helpless but to watch, as a volley gun carved open Lanaxon's wagon from front axle to tailboard. Big Linden tumbled down the steps from the buckboard, leaking blood like a colander. Lorin emerged from beneath the canvas roof, mouthing a cry that was lost somewhere in the ether shade, and sporting a crossbow before a bullet tore out his throat. 2 more punched through his chest, and then Felix heard a snatch of the dwarf's voice before the shadows rolled in. There was Gustav, leading a charge over the splintered remnants of a picket line and into the tight shield wall of heavy infantry that was advancing against them over the bridge. Pistols blossomed from the front rank. He heard and saw men roar, and then there was a clashing together. Gustav's Gospodar sabre flashed, and then the vision was gone.
"No!"
Felix shouted, though with what and to whom he was uncertain.
"Take me back to that last one. Gustav needs my help."
Disconnected visual elements came and went. He saw a stab of orange crest, like the sail of a storm-tossed ship on a swell of armoured mutant warriors. There were ruined buildings webbed with shadow. The darkness swirled through one and bore Felix's flailing consciousness with it. An incredibly muscular figure was crouched by a window. He had a red scarf tied around his forehead and wore a pair of bug-eyed lenses marked with crosshairs, through which he looked down onto the scene below him. Felix couldn't say what the figure was watching. There seemed to be no spatial connection between the images he was passing through, and he didn't know the layout of the township well enough to stitch them together. The marksman raised what looked like a long rifle. It had a long cylindrical barrel attached to the top of the stock, and some kind of scarlet glowstone within it that sent a beam of light in the direction he aimed. And then the darkness pulled them apart again, There was a crack like a thunderbolt, and a mutant warrior in thick steel plate in parshi coloured black and white went down with a steaming crater where his visor had been. Who was attacking who? None of this made sense. The confusion of images and sounds and gunpowder smells arranged themselves into ordered focus. The shadows slunk back to the ether, where, as far as Felix was concerned, they were henceforth invited to remain. With one hand, Felix felt over the side of his body to ensure it was all where he had left it. A wave of dizziness passed through him, as his body delivered two contradictory senses of where he was supposed to be standing right now. Despite what a large, increasingly queasy part of him insisted, he was no longer in the belfry. In fact, he could see the belfry at the far end of the street, the ruin rising out of the tangle of weeds like a memorial stone on the site of a forgotten battlefield. The street between him and it was a grinding churn of armoured warriors, 20 or so Chaos Knights, and half again as many corpses, converging on Gotrick and his axe. The Slayer issued a bloodthirsty peal of thunder and drove his axe through a warrior's raised shield and deep into his groin. Blood spurted across the dwarf's beard. Slivers of splintered steel peppered his snarling face with a metallic finish. A back-slung elbow cracked the side of a warrior's helmet like an egg. A warhammer smacked against the Slayer's shoulder blade and drove him to his knees. The hammer came down to crack his skull open. Gotrick caught the haft of the descending weapon and, in a bulging display of strength, yanked the hammer from the warrior's grip and split it in half across his knee. A bare-knuckled punch as he rose sent a knight with four arms and a droning morning star in each hand crashing through two of his companions with a dented breastplate. A mutant with spines running down his ears and along the outside edges of his hands went down screaming with a shattered shin. Gotrick withdrew his boot and stamped on the knight's thigh as he decapitated him with a single blow of his axe. More came in, smothering the Slayer with sheer weight of numbers. Gotrick was formidable, but he was only one Slayer. Felix cursed under his breath, looking back over his shoulder to where the river was lit up with gunfire like a firework display. Breathing hard, he turned back. For better or worse, Max had brought him here. Gustav and the others would have to look after themselves.
"Wait," said Max, seizing Felix's shoulder at the most disconcerting moment possible, just before he had finalized the decision to charge and directed his muscles to see it done.
"For what?"
"Do you remember poor Claudia?" said Max conversationally, his special brand of madness impervious to the grunts and the cries and the wrench of torn metal. "I feel I understand her a little better now. The power of the Celestial is a blight that no man is equipped to bear."
Felix shook his head as the wizard spoke, noticing as he did so that the multi-barreled chain gun embedded in the ruins opposite the belfry was being pivoted about by a broad-shouldered crew and onto the street. They were going to gun down their own just to take out Gotrick.
"Gotrick, look out!"
Felix yelled, as the powerful weapon opened up, spraying the combatants with fire. By virtue of numbers alone, the mutants took the brunt, forced into an electric dance by the hail of bullets driven through them. Their thick armor offered scant protection, and blood seeped through coin-sized holes front and back. Gotrick took a ding to his rune axe that ricocheted off, leaving a black smudge on the star metal. He roared furiously, then took a shot to the shoulder that punched him down. Felix cried out, breaking free of Max's grip to charge forward. The cannon wound down, but before the dazed survivors could so much as pick themselves up, a roar went up from both sides of the street, and dozens of stocky warriors poured out from hiding amidst the ruins. Once on the open road, they formed grimly into ranks and closed on the surviving mutants, and Felix, like the walls of some mechanical dungeon trap. These were not at all like the mutants Felix had just been fighting. Their tough, practical mail was unembellished, but for the occasional spiked iron vambrace for added brutality at close quarters. Each bore a shield carrying a uniform runic device, tightly locked with their comrade on either side. Felix could see their faces within their open helms. Their cheeks were leathery, noses squashed and red, eyes hard behind their full, unkempt beards. Dwarfs, Felix realized, dismayed. Both he and the mutants had been ambushed by dwarfs. Had they taken one look at Felix's tattered appearance and mistaken him for a mutant himself? Sigmar, he couldn't blame them. And as for Max... A handful of the mutant warriors rallied themselves for a countercharge, throwing themselves onto the advancing shield wall, which seemed to essentially grind over them. The remainder, clearly brighter than the rest, broke and ran, only to be picked off one by one with well-placed shots from marksmen positioned in the neighbouring buildings. The dwarfs held every advantage. They had numbers, enviable discipline, and their superlative night vision had enabled them to ambush the mutants at their most vulnerable moment and take them out at range as they fled piecemeal. The last mutant went down at a sprint with a crossbow bolt protruding from his throat. He collapsed just a few yards from where Felix stood. Gotrek's fate, and what Max's magic had shown him of their camp, left him under no illusion that these dwarfs were rescuers. He was the last man standing simply by virtue of the fact that he had yet to be overtly aggressive or run away. Perhaps they thought him craven enough to be questioned. There was no more to it than that. Could these dwarfs themselves be aligned with the gods of chaos? Stranger things had happened in these dark times, and they would not be the first chaos warband to fall on that of a rival. As he watched, the dwarf formations began to break up, axemen dropping down to deliver mercy kills to the fallen knights. Felix's heart froze. Gotrek! Would these dwarfs recognize what they were doing before it was too late? Would they care?
Wait!
He shouted, throwing down his sword and stepping over it with arms raised, halting only when a quarreler raised his crossbow to aim at Felix's chest. His skin itched, as though it could already feel the bolt whizzing towards it.
My name is Felix Jaeger,
he proclaimed in his loudest and most confident oratorical tone. Uncertain what that was supposed to mean to these dwarfs, but for some reason determined to let them know it anyway. Daring the sharpshooter's iron nerves, he brought his raised hands together over his head to tease off his left glove. Then he lifted that hand, all fingers tucked in by the fourth, to display the rune-inscribed dwarf gold that banded it.
I swore an oath before the Slayer Shrine of Karakadrin. I am the Hammer-Bearer and a Demon Slayer. And on the word of a dwarf friend, stop!
The dwarfs slowly lowered their axes, apparently impressed enough to not kill him. They muttered to each other in Khazalid. Felix saw more than a few shrugs amongst the throng.
Who's in charge here?
Said Felix.
Someone get him a message to stop the attack on our camp.
More urgent muttering. The quarreler finally shouldered his weapon, and Felix slowly lowered his hands, noticing as he did so the red spot that had appeared on his chest. Felix froze. The dot played over his armor for a second, and then vanished. Felix released a relieved breath, catching movement from the corner of his eye, as a muscular dwarf with a bright red crest of hair rose up from behind the rough parapet of the rooftop across the street and laid his large, powerful-looking long rifle down against the stonework. The dwarf was short and immensely broad. He wore a thick leather coat with a high fur-edged collar, which, contrary to spring cold and common sense, he wore open at the front to reveal amazingly defined muscles. Twin bandoliers containing an unusual cylindrical type of ammunition were looped over his shoulders and crossed his chest. His white beard was, most unusually for a dwarf, shaved almost to the jaw. Felix gaped, his open mouth struggling unwittingly into a smile. The dwarf pulled his goggles from his face, leaving them to hang by a rubber strap from his neck, and then pinched his eyes.
Felix Jaeger! I wouldn't believe it, I hadn't seen it with me own eyes. What in the world are you doing here?
Chapter 9. Macason. Malachi Macason flung back the bleak iron doors of the mountaintop citadel and strode into the greeting hall of the ancient dwarfs. Felix imagined that it had been rather more welcoming in the past. Columnar stumps marked out what looked to have been a runic design, possibly with some kind of cultural or even magical significance to the ancient architects of this place, but now left Felix minding the remaining ceiling supports with an unease he was accustomed to in dwarf-built structures. The walls had been constructed with defense foremost in mind, and thus had been built without windows of any kind. Now, however, breaks in the stonework allowed in the night, and the patch jobs, courtesy of canvas and nails, did a poor job of blocking out the breeze. Thick black cabling lay everywhere, running through heaps of rubble and scrambling up columns to what looked like iron gantries, from which an intermittent light flickered and hummed. It was neither torchlight nor the precious glowstones that Malachi had innovatively employed in his handgun, but a cold, soulless kind of glow. The smell of oil lingered on the stones, and Felix could see it on the faces of the dwarfs he saw working on the wall's repair as they turned to him with expressions of wonder. They probably hadn't been expecting company.
"It is the Ennibelta to cake, but she's yours."
Felix assumed that meant it was good. Macason, he had once been told, hailed from an isolated far northern community of dwarfs in the Dwemerdin Valley, and his unusual manner of speech took some reacclimating to. Gotrek regarded the ceiling sourly. Felix could still see lead where the bullet had punched into the bone of Gotrek's shoulder, but it had stopped bleeding, and that, it seemed, was enough for him.
"Not too bad, if you like the feel of rain on your face."
Felix thought it was the nearest thing he had seen to paradise in a long time. Malachi Macason, he thought, with something approaching wonder. He still couldn't believe it. What were the chances? Felix hadn't seen the Slayer engineer since he and Gotrek had last passed through Nuln. Malachi had been teaching at the gunnery school at the time, although Felix had heard through his various military contacts in Altdorf and later from Snorri that the dwarf had returned to Karak Kadrin to play his part in the debacle that was the Sylvanian campaign. Felix had assumed him dead. Snorri had thought so. At that moment, Felix was almost inclined to give in to Max's urgings and to put it all down to destiny.
"I've never seen anything like this," said Gotrek, eyeing the lighting rig suspiciously. "Never in all my years. If the guild ever saw this, your great-great-grandchildren would be swearing the Slayer oath." "Aye, maybe you're right,"
said Malachi, an air of melancholy settling over him as he looked over the hall that he had rebuilt.
"I suppose I will need tell him if ye don't."
Gotrek grumbled darkly, glaring at the cables as if they were snakes.
"How did you come to be in this out-of-the-way place?" asked Max, softly insistent, gliding under the strange artificial light that could find no purchase on his skin.
The wizard had been attacking Malachi with questions almost from the moment the engineer had first presented himself in the township. Felix found his persistence unnerving, but if Malachi felt the same way, then he didn't show it.
"It's a lang tale, young Schreiber, but if you're a mind to hear it..."
Felix held under the threshold as Gotrek, Max, and Malachi walked deeper into the greeting hall. He smiled. For a moment it was just like old times. Malachi Macason had that kind of effect, as if the end of everything was something one just had to look at in the right kind of way. But then his mind filled in for him the shades of those who were missing. One tall, blonde, and achingly beautiful, the other stocky and broad with an idiot grin and a crest of multicoloured nails. With a sigh so deep that the thin air left him dizzy, he turned to look back the way they had come. A scattering of torches marked the line of men, dwarfs, and field guns on rickety wooden wagons as it crawled up the mountainside, throwing random pockets of illumination onto the barren rock and ruin of its surrounds. Both his men and Macason's appeared too tired for bitterness. Just another near tragedy to mark the passing of another day. He tried to follow the snaking trail of men back down to the township, only to be thwarted by whatever cunning design or enchantment protected the dwarf's old paths through the Middle Mountains. The township was a black steepling in the mountain's cleft far below, visible more by the faint twinkle of the stream under the stars than by the buildings themselves. He frowned. Was that another glint of light down there in the ruins? And another over there, further back in the pass where the mountains surrounded the river as it fled for better lands? It was probably just a few mutants that Malachi's force hadn't accounted for. But part of him wished that it was something worse. That worried him. Would this hunger for vengeance pass with the war's end, or their arrival in Middenheim? Or had he been irrevocably tainted by the encroachment of chaos into the old world? Or did the fact that his bloodlust bothered him prove that was not the case? He clung to that thought. It was comforting. "We were being followed by a force of Northmen," said Gustav to the dwarf clansman wedged under his shoulder. His voice was breathy with altitude, and his nose was bleeding again, a scarlet trickle running around his mouth, down his chin, and steadily dripping onto his armor. A ripening black eye already dominated one half of his face. His armor scales had been loosened out to ease the pressure on bruised ribs, and he walked with a wince.
"Don't worry about it," said the dwarf.
He glanced up at Gustav, and then looked away in embarrassment and mumbled,
"Those mutants have been trying to find their way up here for months, and the goblins before them, for who knows how long. Eons. The wastes will freeze over before they get to the top of this mountain."
"Hey, don't touch that!"
Felix turned to see Malachi Mackaysen swat Gotrek's hand away from one of the cables that coiled up the nearest column.
"They're carrying power through the Blackwater generators in the old deeps. My ain design. There were more important uses for the insulation, though. So you're in for a shock if you touch it."
Gotrek scowled, but pulled his hand back just the same. It was probably only Malachi that could get away with talking to Gotrek like that. Felix remained in the doorway just long enough to determine that Gustav, Kolya, Mann, and the dwarf's leaders had everything in hand, before hurrying on after the others. With Malachi's warning in mind, he paid extra heed to where he stepped, taking care to avoid the overfloor cables where they ran through the rubble. He had had enough shocks for one day. It didn't seem very sensible to leave something so dangerous just lying around on the floor, but Felix supposed that the dwarfs were accustomed to it. "What do you mean by more important uses?"
"Ach, you see. But where was I?"
The thrum of some industrial process taking place in a distant quarter of the citadel began to make itself felt through the stones. They approached a stairwell leading up, and Malachi moved towards it with Max in step.
"I knew, and that was who old Ironfist and I got separated after the wee beasties chased us out of Sylvania. I saw who bad things were going to get after that, so I and those stuck with me came to this wished place for a special project."
"You should have gone back to Carrick Cadrin," said Gotrek.
"I hear the Slayerhold went down along after that."
"Aye,"
Gotrek grumbled, deadly serious.
"What of it?"
Felix walked through the crumbling innards of the castle and was overcome with awe. Steam filled the corridors and walkways that Malachi led them through, hissing between the bolted sections of great rusted pipes. Every few dozen steps they passed a room filled with unusual machinery. In some, pistons rose and fell as if the mountain was sucking in steam. In others, internal walls had been knocked down to create space for rank upon rank of huge gleaming engines that put Felix in mind of some infernal printing press. A juddering conveyor carried complicated metallic components from press to press, all attended by a single dwarf who made notes in a small book. Every stone shook, as if the castle was being bombarded from above, and everywhere dwarfs moved about with a purpose. Felix had to remind himself that it was the middle of the night outside. Malachi Mackaysen had constructed something astounding out here in the middle of nowhere, and Felix felt an urgent need to know why. Knowing the Slayer engineer as Felix did, he expected it to be both wondrous and destructive. With a warrior's eye, Felix looked about for signs of the weapons that the dwarfs were undoubtedly fashioning here to turn the tide against the hordes of chaos, but could find nothing obvious. In what looked like finishing rooms, dwarfs in long-sleeved white overclothes blasted steel sheets with steam hoses, while others buffed and polished. Machines that looked like iron-toothed mouths attached to conveyors spat nails into buckets that were then loaded onto carts for distribution. Felix stepped to one side to allow a burly dwarf with a sweat-sodden grey beard to barrel down the narrow corridor behind a wheelbarrow filled with thick metal plates. Some quixotic type of armor, perhaps. Felix could not for the life of him imagine what sort of monster Malachi intended to clad with it. Gotrek watched the barrow rattle down the corridor, jaw clenched. Felix knew the Slayer was as curious about what Malachi was up to here as he was. He also knew that Gotrek was far too stubborn to ever ask. "All right," said Felix. "We give up. What are you doing here?"
"We've all got our own weapons to bring to these times, young Felix. And these are mine."
"Forgive me, but they don't look much like weapons."
"Neither do, laddie,"
Malachi grinned, stubbing his nose with a finger as thick and browned with grease as a sausage. Gotrek snorted, though over what, Felix wasn't minded to ask.
"It's destiny," said Max.
The steam billowed through his robes as though he had just been summoned from some black dimension. He leaned into his staff and gazed about himself with bleak-eyed wonder.
"It has to be. What else could reunite us all at such a pivotal moment in time?"
Malachi rested the muzzle of his gun on his shoulder and shrugged.
"Maybe it is, and maybe it isn't. It doesn't seem to make a difference either way. You kick it, though, does it?"
Felix shook his head ruefully. Why hadn't he thought of telling Max that?
"And anyway,"
Malachi went on,
"I can see a few are in here. Did poor Snorri Nose might get his memory back?"
He turned to Felix with a half-cocked grin.
"And who about ye wee lass, Ulrika?"
Felix's heart skipped a beat when he heard the question. He turned to Gotrek. Gotrek glared back. Felix's tongue felt as though it was stuck to the roof of his mouth.
"They both fell in Kislev," said Gotrek,
his one eye fixed on Felix.
"Well, I'm sure it was a good death. We'll drink to Snorri's honour when all this is over."
Malachi reached out and took Felix's shoulder in a consoling grip. It felt like being crushed under a rock, but Felix barely felt it.
"And I'm sorry about Ulrika. She were a braw lass wi' a good heart."
Felix felt Gotrek's eye on him, and looked away just as a dwarf with a screaming circular saw sheared through the neck of a silvery white sheet of metal.
"Yes," he answered hoarsely. "Here she was."
They passed through dozens more corridors and several further sets of stairs, always rising, until Felix was well and truly lost and desperate for a window, if only to assure himself of where he was in relation to the outside. They passed tap rooms in which dwarfs drank and smoked with the same dour determination with which they worked. A steam whistle wailed through the halls, making Felix jump when it first went off behind his ear. The sound hung in the air for several seconds after the initial blast. Felix counted them, cringing a little with every added number at the thought of what dark thing might lurk in the valley and be drawn to such a din. To the dwarfs, however, it appeared to represent nothing more terrible than a shift change. Workers in leather overalls covered in soot and oil and with protective gloves hanging from their wrists, staggering into bunk rooms to rouse bleary-eyed comrades and slump into their still warm beds. Watching them made Felix's eyelids feel heavy, and he tried and failed to suppress a yawn. In rooms lined with armor dummies and weapon racks, dwarfs shed work gear and strapped on mail and shields, no doubt for a shift patrolling the township below or manning the citadel's walls. The dwarfs were a dying race, Felix knew, and had been for millennia. As such, they had few professional soldiers. Their armies comprised largely of dwarfs like these, who set aside their trades in favor of axes in times of war. Even knowing that, Felix was impressed by their fortitude. On the door of one such barracks room, a large circular target had been mounted, and as Felix walked by, a dwarf in half-tied mail aimed a bulky crossbow towards him. Felix's heart leapt into his mouth. The dwarf was clearly blurry-eyed from overwork, or else maddened by chaos. The dwarf pulled on the trigger, and a second later the yellow ring in the center of the target bristled with iron bolts. Steam hissed from the strange mechanism riveted to the basic crossbow chassis in place of the conventional drawstring and crank, as the dwarf lowered his weapon and moved to tuck his bolts out of the door. He grunted a greeting to Mackayson as they marched past. Felix turned to glance back before they turned onto another corridor.
"What kind of weapon was that?"
King Bernoth, Grundadrak of Baragvar, tasked me to gear my crossbow faster and better than them the dark elf scallies were using against shipping. New bolts get fed into the track through a hopper and forced out with a wee burst of steam from a powerful chute.
Malachi shrugged as if he were describing the operation of hammer and nail.
But old Grundadrak in his wisdom didn't like what they cost to build, so I kept the few I made for myself. I wonder what's left of the old place now.
Baragvar, said Felix, and shrugged. He thought of Collier's map, the great empty swathe south of the Talabek and west of the Middle Mountains.
She is beset, but stands, the last stone on the path to the Everpeak, said Max quietly, eyes averted. Vermin rule in her deep places, and like rotten grain from a breached drum they spill from their conquests in Herne, Izor, Eight Peaks, and Azul.
For a minute everyone walked in silence. Felix turned to Gotrek. He had learned from Snorri that the two dwarfs had used to live in a hill town, much like the ancient township they had just passed through, under the protection of Karazakarak, the Everpeak, as men knew the capital of the ancient dwarf realm. In a sense, Gotrek was learning of the plight of his home, much as Felix had just days before. The Slayer stared grimly ahead as if it meant nothing. And perhaps it didn't, Felix thought with a sigh. Then Malachi sucked in through his teeth and spat on the ground.
Well, that doesn't sound to good, does it?
No, Felix agreed, meaning to say something more, but unable to find the words for it.
If you go in for that sort of talk, Gotrek muttered.
The corridor came to an end in what looked like a vast feasting hall. Great ceiling arches soared above them, carved into the likeness of long-beard dwarfs, striking together tankards of ale over the center of the hall where they met. Each was a work of art, and that they had endured the millennia in such a recognizable state did credit to the dwarfs that had poured such loving labor into their artifice. Scores of low-slung tables filled the tiniest portion of the room, leaving the rest to cracked tiles and more of that black cabling that seemed as pernicious in this castle as weeds. A handful of dwarfs in armor sat at just one of them, picking at the thin-looking vegetables that wallowed in gravy in their trenches. Felix felt his mouth water and heard his stomach growl. He thought of the empty crates and sacks in his company's wagons, and looked about himself with fresh wonder, and almost hope. There must be hundreds of dwarfs here. Far from enough to win the war, but enough to make a difference if used wisely. Enough to hurt the enemy, to let the dark gods know that there were still those who fought them. Whatever Gotrek's misgivings about Malachi Mackaysen's intentions, Felix felt sure that the ancients who had once lived here would have approved. It had to be something truly remarkable to warrant such an expenditure of resources and the dedication of so many. Malachi's footsteps echoed from the grandiose beams as the Slayer engineer strode towards a large set of double doors at the far end of the hall and flung them wide. Cold mountain air rushed through. It carried the scent of engine grease and oil and the barely discernible hum of some kind of idling engine. Felix stepped out into the night. The wind, reminded of its strength so high above the world, tore between the castle's battlements and riffled through Felix's hair and cloak. With one hand positioned for safety on the pitted basalt of the rampart beside him, he restrained his hair with the other. Gotrek peered over the side and spat down. He watched it fall for a long time, and then grunted with what sounded like approval. The castle's uppermost fortifications had been filled with a forest of metal girders, made into a towering scaffold by horizontal and diagonal beams, and ringed with walkways and ladders and dangling ropes. Steel-wound hawsers, the thickness of Felix's arm, fed through massive brass rings that had been unceremoniously bolted into the ramparts and swept up to some mysterious point in the sky. They bobbed up and down, as though attached to a ship that rolled with the waves. Beside Felix, Max, however, was looking up, his dark eyes alive with visions of destiny. Felix joined him, feeling his excitement rise as the blinking spots overhead that he'd initially mistaken for stars turned out to be a string of guide lights employing the same arcane technology with which Mackayson had illuminated his castle. A shape emerged from the darkness as Felix's eyes adapted to it. A huge, gleaming curve like the underbelly of a whale. Cold light glinted from the riveted metal hanging beneath it. Felix was lost for words. They could do it. They could reach Middenheim. They could do anything.
Aye,
said Malachi Mackayson, arriving in between Felix and Max and winding both men with a firm clap on the back.
Did you miss her?
The children of the tribes ran amongst the beaten Middle Mountains fighters, laughing and squealing as they pulled faces, danced around discarded blades and kicked at men's shins. It was an old game. Kagesh Fell, as old as the tribes themselves, remembered when he had run amongst captured warriors of the Yusak to prove to his father that their enemies did not frighten him. That had been more than a lifetime ago. Gods had been and passed since then. Reining in his enormous black warhorse, Kagesh Fell dismounted. His boots hit the ground with a thump of meteoric iron. A frightened murmur passed amongst the mutant warriors as they saw him approach. They had dwelt here too long, hidden in these mountains and deaf to the Dark Master's call. They were Empire men, and thus born with water in their bones. They had forgotten how it felt to look upon a true champion of chaos and no terror.
Who leads you? He intoned.
Silence. One by one, Kagesh Fell cracked the knuckles of his hand. At least one man moaned. The tribe's outriders had herded up just under 40 of the mewling chattel. Those few in whom the Dark Master's blessing was most evident were picketed here on the stone ground by the river at the town's entrance, surrounded by a ring of tribesmen and beasts. The rest he could still hear screaming as they were fed into the great cauldron that had been set up in the valley beyond the walls, to be boiled alive in the traditional manner reserved for the blood enemies of the tribes. Kagesh Fell was pleased to hear the old ways being upheld in the midst of such upheaval. He approached the man who had made a sound. Self-evidently, he was weak of heart, and likely also of body and spirit. The man had been divested of his helm, revealing a wide mouth filled with poisonous green teeth. His beard flexed unnaturally of its own volition, and his pale westerner's skin was slippery with sweat. Kagesh Fell ground his teeth at the stench of urine rising from the man's folds. The man condemned himself still further with a whimper.
Who leads you?
He's dead, O mighty one, slain in battle with the dwarves and their allies.
Kagesh Fell glanced to the castle that sat atop the mountain to his left. There was a road leading from it to the town, but as hard as he focused on it, he could not force his eyes to track it all the way down. Mentally, he bade the eye of Kachar to open and reveal the path's true course to him. But it was a gift of the gods, and not his to command, and it remained stubbornly shut.
Then who now leads you?
The weakling warrior glanced for support to his comrades, who, showing equal sallowness of spirit, averted their faces. He opened his mouth and stuttered, then screamed as Kagesh Fell swooped down to grab him by the throat and drag him 2 feet off the ground. And now the man fought. Too little, too late. The mutant kicked out at full stretch to dink his toe on the warlord's breastplate, working his large mouth for a bite on the tattooed skin around his neck. Kagesh Fell tightened his grip until the man's eyes bugged out of his face and his lips drained of color.
Had I and my people not come here, to whom would you have turned?
The man opened his mouth and stared, perhaps seeing the great eagle come to snatch away the soul of the craven and bear it to its damnation. The creak of cartilage echoed up from his constricting throat.
Who?
A frightened murmur passed through the watching captives, maybe seeing their own fate in the warrior's slow death. All except one. His eyes narrowed. A slender old crone observed the scurrying children with an awkward look of affection. She was draped in black silks, ice-white hair pierced by dark horns. As if only then noticing his presence, she drew her attention from the children to regard him. Her skin was a chalky black. Her eyes shimmered like scrying pools. Kargashfell felt a thrill of recognition, of destinies coming together in the time and manner that they must. His guide. His prophet. Watching proceedings from the bare back of his grey horse, Nagui traced a ward against evil through the air. Strips of blue silk danced across the pony's muzzle. The chimes sewn into his robes tinkled in warning.
She is a witch, warlord, and a potent one. Be wary when you question her, and kill her swiftly afterwards.
The woman smiled, baring teeth like tiny knives. Nagui's brown face contorted in anger, and he held out a hand to his acolytes for his staff. One of them had handed the eagle-feathered rod to him before Kargashfell could raise a hand for peace.
"Do you not fear death?" he asked. "Or do you think perhaps that I will not turn my blade on a woman?"
"Everyone fears death, half-ogre. But I know that you cannot kill me."
"She is a prophetess,"
hissed someone from amongst the gathered tribesmen, before Kargashfell could glare into them his will for silence. Nagui raised his staff until it was held vertical. He began to shake it rhythmically up and down, so that the glass-eyed beads threaded through its feathers shook. In time, he pounded on his chest with an open palm. Kargashfell recognized the chant as one of dispelling, but it felt suddenly childish when brought before the god-touched prophetess, so composed in her own power that she did not even look at the tribe's shaman as he spoke.
"Do you claim that you can see your own death?"
said Nagui.
"Can you not?"
The shaman laughed, grinning to his acolytes and the warriors around him who had ridden with him over countless leagues and many years, and who now laughed with him.
"Perhaps these greater gods have something finer in store for me."
The woman glanced at Kargashfell. The corner of her lips curled. Prismatic fragments of something terribly profound glittered across her eyes. Kargashfell found himself absorbed. There was truth there. He could feel it, as only one great power could recognize in another. And she saw something similar in him, he knew. He regarded her in a wholly different light. He had lost 4 sons. It had been many centuries, but he would need more if he was to found a dynasty to rule the Dark Master's empire.
"Perhaps they do indeed,"
she answered, sharp as a crystal blade. Unbeknownst to the men around him, Nagui had stopped laughing. He rattled his staff fiercely.
"Your foresight did not serve your former master, witch."
For a moment the seeress looked sad.
"It is not prophecy that I give you, but the future, as it can only be. If all men were blessed equally by fate, then none would be happier about it than I."
"And what do you see, prophetess?"
said Kargashfell eagerly.
"Your people believe the dead see things that the living do not. You are right. Long ago I died, or should have, but for the blind heroism of a man centuries unborn. And now I see as the living cannot. I see the end of things and a future, a world on which the doom of great warriors will touch."
"Are all your visions so opaque?" Nagui sneered.
"I see you in battle, with the hero you seek,"
she said, ignoring the shaman and addressing Kargashfell, then turning to point a clawed finger to the old castle on the mountain.
"There. A battle to the death."
Kargashfell grinned.
"Good luck,"
said Nagui, lowering his staff.
"The tribes know well the magic of the dwarfs and their black kin. These are hidden ways. There is no way to that castle."
The prophetess turned back to Kargashfell.
"The one you hunt is marked by destiny. The fates of worlds still unborn converge upon him. His doom draws near, and his passage is as the setting of the moon to my eyes. I am Morzana, prophetess of the Dark Master, and this one once saved my life.
She extended her small clawed hand, and despite Nagui's warning hiss, Kargashvel dropped the now limp corpse in his grip and took it, swallowing it in his ogreish palm.
Come, half-ogre. Allow me to guide you to your destiny.
Chapter 10 Unstoppable.
You're a genius, Felix breathed,
craning his neck as far back as it would go, and gulping at the dark behemoth that strained on its hawsers like a harpooned whale. It was an airship. The darkness gave Felix only the vague impression of sleek contours, an outline defined by the glow of guidelights, but he could say without fear of contradiction that this new airship was every bit as immense as the first. It would be a squeeze, but Felix saw no reason why it couldn't carry all of Malachi's dwarfs and all of Felix's men wherever they needed to go. Already the possibilities were racing through his mind. Flying to Middenheim was just the beginning. They could drop bombs on the Chaos Hordes as they attempted to scale the Faustschlag. Utilizing the airship's phenomenal speed and range, they could ferry in supplies from all over the world, or scour the land for survivors, unifying the Empire again in its common struggle. As history now remembered Magnus the Pious and Prague, perhaps children 2 centuries hence would learn the names of Malachi Mackaysen and Middenheim. It was only one airship, but the implications were endless. The guidelights glinted from the steel rims of glass portholes and from the barrels of organ guns and the blades of rotors. They turned dreamily, and it was these that were responsible for the quiet drone that Felix could hear against the wind. Looking closer, Felix could see that there were gaps in the bodywork of the fragile metal vehicle that dangled from the gas bag. The airship was unfinished, but it looked wondrous enough for Felix.
"You rebuilt the spirit of Grungni."
"I called her unstoppable," said Malachi,
stomping across the blustery rampart to the side of the great steel tower, where a mechanism of wheels and cables had been bolted to the scaffold, adjoining what looked like a pair of parallel vertical rails that headed straight up. Malachi stood beside the contraption and put his hands on his hips. The wind bent his crest at the roots and ruffled his collar.
"It's what I always wanted to call the Larsian. I knew there's nobody to see otherwise."
He patted the scaffold.
"This yin's all mine."
"There are holes in it," said Gotrick.
"She isn't ready yet, is she, you big wazzock?"
"How did you get enough lift gas to fill the gas bag?" Felix cut in before Gotrick could respond with anything even more insulting. "You told me before that it was difficult to find. You'd built a whole town to manufacture the stuff."
"You're right, laddie. Well, that's a sensible question."
Malachi glared pointedly at Gotrick, who snorted, and turned his back to go and pace the ramparts.
"The old mines all over this place were filled with the stuff. We just pumped it out."
"And what about fuel?" said Gotrick.
The dwarf paced with arms crossed, gripping his swollen biceps, but his one eye glittered with an excitement that Felix suspected he could not entertain until every possible flaw had been gone over and cast aside.
"There's nothing in these mountains, and never has been. No gold, no iron, and no coal either. Everything we use came with us from Silveria. But you're right, there isn't much black water in the tank. Enough to fly us to Karazakarak in a good wind."
"That's where you're going," said Felix, feeling much of his excitement ebb away. He'd been foolish to think that Malachi would want to fly his airship north when he could take it home to aid his own people. No doubt the dwarfs stood a better chance anyway. If anything had a right to describe itself as impregnable, then the Everpeak was it. For a moment Felix considered asking Malachi to take them all with him. It would undoubtedly be safer there than Middenheim ever could be. But more than that, there was the prospect of Skaven to fight, if Max's reports were to be believed. There was a debt of blood still owed there. He sighed and let the bloodlust go. There was no point to it. If he found the rat that murdered his father, then what would change? No, he knew where he had to go, and had been resigned to walking it before this. As soon as he arrived at that decision, breathing felt a little easier, as if a pressing weight had been removed from his shoulders. He felt as though he had been tested somehow, and had passed.
"That's where he was going,"
said Gotrek, turning to face the engineer. He tightened his grip on his biceps until the muscles of his chest and neck bulged. The bullet wound in his shoulder oozed.
"Now he's going to Middenheim."
"We can fight about it when she's good to go,"
said Malachi, meeting the other slayer's bleak stare without blinking.
"It's just a waste of breath until she is."
The engineer reached behind him and pulled on a lever that was part of the mechanism at his back. As he did, there was a hiss of vented steam from the top of the scaffold, and then a metallic wail as a small iron cage came hurtling down the vertical tracks. Just before it looked as if it was going to shatter on the roof of the castle, it slowed, issuing what sounded like a sigh, and then bumped home with a clumsy kiss of metal upon stone. Steam rushed out from the braking mechanism, flooding Mackayson to the knees as he pulled open the metal door, turned to Felix and beamed.
"I ken you'd want to see her, for old time's sake."
Felix didn't know what to say. Seeing the airship was like being reunited with an old friend, every bit as exhilarating as finding Malachi himself alive and well. More so, in fact, he was ashamed to admit. Taking his gawping silence as assent, Malachi turned to Max, who nodded once, and then to Gotrek, who grunted and shook his head.
"It looks the same as the last one. I think I'll go and see what my so-called remember's up to."
The slayer touched his damaged shoulder and drew in a sharp breath.
"Maybe I'll see about this too,"
he added grudgingly.
Sorry about that,"
said Mackayson, sounding almost genuinely contrite. Gotrek bared his yellowed teeth.
"Next time, aim a little lower."
"You should get some rest," said Felix, promising himself that he'd curl up somewhere too, just as soon as he'd had one glimpse inside of the airship. "I can't remember the last time I saw you close your eye."
"Plenty of time for that, manling,"
Gotrek muttered wearily as he turned away.
"Plenty of time."
The elevator cage was, mercifully, much slower on the ascent than it had been on the way down. Felix wondered whether some technical marvel instructed it when passengers were aboard and to adjust its speed accordingly, but opted to save his questions in favour of clutching the bars of the cage as his stomach dropped through his feet and the ramparts of the castle disappeared below. The metal girders of the scaffold flitted by, the cage shuddering as it climbed higher. Felix tightened his grip until his knuckles were white.
"Exhilarating," said Max, in a cold tone that didn't know the meaning of the word.
"You get bored of it,"
Malachi shouted over the wind that the climbing elevator sucked in and down. Felix disagreed, and heartily so. He had travelled in similar devices to this one, both above ground and under it, where such technology was commonplace in the minds of the dwarfs, and however he picked through the gamut of feelings rifling through his innards, boredom was conspicuous by its absence. Felix clung to the sides and watched the airship bloat as he was drawn nearer, the metal gondola that hung beneath the gas bag flashing faster and faster between various bars and stanchions, until the elevator cage arrived at the top of the scaffold for an unimpeded view of Malachi Mackayson's awesome invention. There was a squeal of brakes, and Felix's view was filled with steam that gouted from a whirring array of wheels at the terminus of the tracks, as well as from the elevator itself. Felix's heart lurched as the elevator slowed. He shivered in the cloud of condensing steam as the cage arrived in its housing with a, he supposed, reassuring bang, and Malachi drew back the door, this time on the opposite side of the cage to the one they had entered, opening onto the scaffold. Felix was the last out, stepping onto a timber gangplank that wobbled dangerously underfoot, and immediately regretting looking down. His stomach turned a somersault, and he had to fight the urge to fold down to his knees, grip the gangplank, and never ever let go. He had been higher, he knew. He had sailed higher than mountains in the spirit of Grungni, but there was something about seeing that distance quite clearly beneath your feet that made it seem a great deal higher. And besides, he thought queasily, trying to remember which side of the scaffold faced the roof of the castle and which a drop over the parapet, this whole castle was built onto a mountain top. Willing his stomach to settle and his arms and legs to stop shaking, Felix followed after Malachi and Max to the edge of the scaffold, where another sickeningly slender length of wood ran to an open door in the gondola's side. The plank was secured at each end with brass rings that rolled around the stanchion as the airship shifted in the wind. He supposed that looked vaguely sturdy. He watched as Malachi bounded across like a goat. The gangplank wobbled alarmingly under the dwarf's bulk, but not enough to dissuade Max from gliding across after him. Felix took a deep breath, and this time remembered not to look down, holding out his arms for balance as he practically ran across and jumped into Malachi's arms.
"Welcome aboard!"
Malachi yelled, as Felix stepped reverently onto the iron deck and looked around at the small boarding chamber. A single white light shone from a fixed point in the ceiling, illuminating metal rivets and the edges of plates. It was all so well polished that Felix could see his blurred reflection in them. He scratched his graying beard ruefully, turning a full circle before coming to the circular door hatch that led into the interior of the gondola. It was solid steel, and unlike an ordinary door, was opened by rotating a wheel mechanism in the center and then waiting for the locks to release. Felix didn't understand the logic behind the design, but the dwarfs had similar systems aboard their submersibles as well, so he assumed it served some purpose, for dwarfs were nothing if not pragmatic. With a glance at Malachi for permission, Felix took the wheel in his hands. His heart was hammering. He ran his hands around the smooth curve of the metal. For a moment, he felt as if he could turn this wheel, stand back, and find Ulrika and Snorri and everyone else waiting for him on the other side. He smiled. And then he, Gotrek, and Snorri would escape below for a good hard drinking session before the ship got underway. He sighed, a lump in his throat. He would never have thought, living through those terrible adventures, that those would be the best days of his life. What he would give now for one more argument with Ulrika, or a hungover Snorri nosebiter as the greatest of his problems. He was surprised to find himself even missing Gotrek. The Slayer was still around, of course, but what Felix found himself yearning for was his friend. Malachi reached around him and gave the wheel a gentle downwards tug to set it spinning.
"A wee bit stiff for human hands,"
he said, with an understanding squeeze of Felix's shoulder. Malachi was remarkably empathetic for a Slayer.
"Yes, a little. No doubt I'll get used to it."
"So, what do you both want to see first?"
The dwarf's infirmary was the busiest part of the castle, playing host to a steady stream of minor injuries from the battle, as well as the cuts, scalds, and bruises that seemed an everyday part of life for the workers here. Behind a partially screened-off corner, a craggy-faced elder with his long grey beard held in a net chewed on the stem of an unlit pipe and concentrated on sewing shut a nasty-looking cut on a warrior's arm. A younger dwarf watched over his shoulder, on hand with a damp cloth and a half-empty jug of ale, and prepared to deploy either one. Elsewhere, dwarfs in blood-stained leather aprons and gloves hurried about bearing trays of what looked like instruments of torture. One particularly grim-looking dwarf threw a bucket of sickly red water over a drain in the floor. Men moaned. Some lay unconscious on tables. Dwarfs sat stoically upright on benches, or else stood, suffering their injuries as only dwarfs could. Allowing the cruel alchemy by which crippled men were transformed back into soldiers to proceed around the table at which he sat, Gustav slowly unwound the fetid bandage from his hand. It felt like grinding one's fist into a bruise. A sour milk smell emerged as it unraveled. He probably should have changed the bandage sooner, but what did he know? He wasn't a healer, and it wasn't as if clean cloth had been spilling from their empty grain sacks. He reassured himself that nothing dead ever smelled that bad.
"The Dushaika wise woman said always to do it quickly," said Kolya, leaning onto the low table over a plate of something indescribable in gravy and a mug of something worse.
I bet that's what all the ladies told you, Gustav replied, forcing a smirk. Kolya grinned, massaging his ribs, bruised but luckily not broken following a battering by a dwarf shield, then shuffled uncomfortably on his bench. It had been made to seat a body half his height, and with a backside twice the girth of his.
I know 7 languages, friend Gustav. There are many peoples beyond the northern face of the Goramadni, and I have almost as many wives there.
He settled and shrugged.
Winters are long on the frozen sea, no?
You married more than once, said Gustav, not in the least bit shocked by anything this northern savage might do. The man spoke Kurgan, and insofar as Gustav cared to differentiate, was practically Kurgan himself. He remembered that the Kislevite had been a winged lancer in his old life, as well as a hunter. He thought of the pictures of proud riders in gorgeous mail, accoutred with amber and jet, cloaked in animal skins with coloured pennants flying from their lances amidst the famous feathered wings on their backs. It was difficult to reconcile that image with the hemp-clad ruffian that Gustav had grudgingly come to know.
"Life is not horse," said Kolya with a shrug.
"Does that mean something?"
"If you are Kislevite."
The final layer of bandaging came away stickily, flesh clinging to the final strip of cloth as Gustav peeled it back. His nose wrinkled in protest, and he grimaced as he attempted to flex his fingers. His hand was still red raw, the skin mottled with partially healed blisters. After everything he had gone through in Kislev, outliving even the accursed vampiric beauty who still haunted the beating of his heart, to be laid low by a misfiring pistol was a cruel fate. Kolya pushed his bowl across the table towards Gustav.
"The dwarf who gave it me said it was fortifying."
He mimed a spoon-to-the-mouth motion.
"Eat."
Gustav examined the thick stew, trying to identify the misshapen lumps that floated in it like dead bodies in the Avar. He turned to the dwarf beside him, who, with his arm in a sling, had his bowl to his lips and was slurping with gusto. Seeing Gustav's regard, the dwarf set down his bowl and clapped his lips.
"Tastes like chicken."
"I'll take your word for it," Gustav said, pushing the bowl back towards Kolya. The Kislevite stuck his finger in it for a taste, then shrugged and picked up his spoon.
"Makes men wish for a cup of kvass to see a taste buds, no?"
Ignoring him, Gustav again tried to force his fingers to clench. Blisters popped and dead skin pulled as far as it would stretch, until the pain became too great and he had to relax. He wondered if he would ever wield a sword properly again.
"My uncle used the exact same gunpowder as I did. Why am I the one with the ruined hand?"
"Do you wish you had both been hurt?" said Kolya.
"Of course not."
The Kislevite shrugged and thumbed something gristly from the corner of his lip.
"Is of no matter. Do you think I do not wish ill on that axe-wielding Zubogka of a dwarf?"
"That's different. Following Gotrek's like being chained to a hippogriff."
"You are on a fast horse to nowhere, friend Gustav. Some men ride with reins and stirrups, but us..."
He raised his spoon in a toast.
"We hold on and pray to Ursun we do not fall, and hope our destiny follows in the path of others more gifted."
"I'm not following anyone," Gustav muttered, willing his fingers to curl, as if that alone would prove him correct.
"Unlike you, I can leave whenever I want."
"Then leave."
Gustav opened his mouth, but then hesitated. He could abandon his uncle's path, of course he could. But what would he do then, if he did? He had discussed the idea of making for Averheim with several of the company's sergeants. It made sense to have a contingency,